The moment Lakesh coalesced from the carrier beam, he knew something wasn't right. Not wrong, exactly, but he sensed an overall sensation of being slightly off. He stood in the gateway chamber, swaying dizzily, waiting for the vertigo to pass and the sparkshot mist to fade. He checked himself over to make sure all his parts, even his green bodysuit with the rainbow insignia of the historical division, had made the transition. As one of the very first human beings whose entire molecular structure had been converted to digital information and transmitted along a hyperdimensional path and reassembled into the organic original, Lakesh was inured to the physical side effects. Even before the new cost and his century-long cryonic sleep, he knew more about quantum interphase Mattrans inducers than any other person alive. Now, over 200 years after his inaugural Mattrans jump, he was the only human who was intimate with all of the device's maddeningly intricate workings. That specialized knowledge made him a valuable treasure to Baron Cobalt. There were other refugees from pre-dark time scattered throughout the network of Vills, scientists and statesmen, but he was the last of the original architects of Project Cerberus, the keystone of the totality concept. He was also a traitor to the oath he had sworn 2 centuries ago, as well as to the one he had taken upon his revival and induction into the Trust. Turning the handle in a pewter-gray armaglass door, Lakesh stepped out of the jump chamber. As usual, the little control complex, hidden in a strong room on level A of the administrative monolith, was deserted. Nevertheless, he was back in the world of the Baronies, of the Vills. They were all alike. Ragnarville to the extreme north, Sharpville to the east, Palladiumville to the south. Dedicated to spreading the doctrines of the Archon Directorate, the walled cities with their planned ghettos offered meaning for the elite and a lifetime of thankless servitude for the underclass. Lakesh hated the Vills. In them, the modes of dress, even the thoughts, were imposed from without. Only the Gateway Chamber offered even a temporary escape from the Baron's veiled tyranny. Knowledge and use of the Gateway Unit was restricted to the Baron, his personal staff, and a few very select members of the Trust. Only Lakesh enjoyed free and unmonitored access to the chamber. When he reactivated the Cerberus Redoubt, he had made certain the unit there possessed no traceable transit feed connections to any other functioning gateway. Even if someone had the knowledge to replay the computer records of the jumps made from the Cobaltville unit, they would not show his true destination. Rerouting data infeed circuitry had been the work of only 5 minutes. As he crossed the control room, he reflected on his reservoir of good fortune. So far, his double life hadn't been questioned, and if the Magistrate Division harbored suspicions, they knew better than to voice them. His role as senior archivist in the Historical Division was a front. As far as the Baron was concerned, his true purpose was to ferret out any and all archivists who stumbled across information regarding humanity's long relationship with the Archons and report them to the proper authorities. In reality, Lakesh used his position to select likely prospects to join his underground resistance movement. So far, his only real success had been Bridget Baptiste, and even she would have been lost to him if not for the unforeseen involvement of Kane. As a scientist, he was unaccustomed to dealing with visceral emotions. The larger, logical part of his mind knew his tiny enclave of exiles could never overthrow the Directorate or their intermediaries, the Barons, certainly not by staging a guerrilla war. Humankind, at least those who were Vill-bred, had been beaten into docility ages ago. In the Outlands, a fragile, disorganized freedom remained. Pockets of roamers, half-feral mutants who had survived the purges, and tribes of Amerindians who had returned to their traditional way of life. But even taken together, they represented only a small minority. The population of hybrids swelled even as the few remaining human beings were killed or bred and co-opted out of existence. Lakesh fought back a surge of guilt. It wasn't an emotion he was used to grappling with, and certainly not one he enjoyed. Nevertheless, the guilt was neither neurotic nor misplaced. He and other 20th century scientists had willingly traded in their human heritage for a shockscape of planet-wide ruin. After all, they had been selected to survive in order to reshape humankind in a non-human image. He reached the door leading to the anteroom and paused to slip into the persona of a wizened, slightly dotty senior archivist. His shoulders slumped, his liver-spotted hands acquired a slight palsy, and his bespectacled eyes took on a vacant look, as if he were staring at some distant point. So far, his luck at portraying a semi-senile favorite of the Baron had held, although odds were it would fail him sooner or later. His memory leaped back to New Year's Eve 2000. He and other members of Project Cerberus had been allowed to leave their subterranean vanadium alloy tower in Dulce to witness firsthand the arrival of the new millennium. He had never been to Manhattan before, and the awareness that it would become a radioactive slag heap in less than a month had added a heart-wrenching poignance to the visit. In the company of fellow scientists and security wardens, he had attended a Broadway show, a revival of an old musical, Guys and Dolls. A member of the Baronial Guard waited for him. His crisp white uniform jacket, red silken trousers, and polished black boots were impeccable, without unwanted creases or wrinkles. The man's coffee-colored face bore no discernible expression. Lakesh blinked at him in mild, owlish surprise. Inwardly, his heart lurched, and his belly performed a cold flip-flop.
"Come with me, sir."
Lakesh made a vague hand gesture.
"My duties await—"
"The Baron awaits you."
As far as the Baronial Guard was concerned, there was no difference between announcing that the Baron was waiting and that God was waiting. The man turned smartly on a heel and marched forward. There was no need for him to look back to see if Lakesh followed him. The senior archivist had no choice but to shuffle along in the uniformed man's wake. They walked through a magnificent chandelier-lit foyer. At the far end of the foyer, flanking huge ivory and gold inlaid double doors, stood two other guards. Faces impassive, they opened the doors, and Lakesh walked between them into a deeply shadowed passageway. The guard who had fetched him stayed behind, assuming that Lakesh knew his destination. The passageway led into a room through a wide, low arch. Another room lay beyond, and another, all illuminated by the gray glow from an unseen light source. In the fifth and final room, Lakesh joined the semicircle of eight men standing in the center of an enormous Persian carpet. Lakesh's seamed face didn't register surprise, though it required a terrific effort. The entire membership of the Cobaltville Trust was present. His mind wheeled with conjectures, speculations, and fears. He had no idea how the Baron knew when he would arrive, and thus convene a meeting of the Trust. Since the Dulce strike, the Baron hadn't scheduled a meeting of members. Every vill in the network had its own version of the Trust, the only face-to-face contact allowed with the Barons. The oath of the Trust revolved around a single theme: the presence of the Directorate must not be revealed to humanity. If it became known, if the truth behind the nuke cost filtered down to the public, then mankind would doubtless rebel, and the Directorate would be forced to visit another holocaust upon the face of the Earth, simply as a measure of self-preservation. Maintaining the secrecy of the Directorate and their work was a sacred trust. It was a sworn and solemn duty offered to very few. Lakesh glanced casually at the men standing stiffly in the gloom. There was iron-haired and bearded Abrams, the magistrate administrator. He leaned against a cane in his left hand to relieve the weight from his right leg, a leg Kane had crippled in Dulce. Beside him stood Ojaka, a balding Asian and one of the Baron's personal staff. Only by a close scrutiny of his face could one see that his nose had been broken in the past few months. Kane's fist was responsible for the damage. Small, paunchy Gwende bore no visible reminders of his encounter with the rogue magistrate. Kane had been the most merciful with him during their encounter in the Dulce complex. The same couldn't be said for Salvo, who stood behind the three men. Kane had broken a couple of his ribs, kicked out his teeth, and fractured his skull. Salvo sensed Lakesh's glance, and his dark eyes flicked coldly in his direction. Lakesh met the gaze mildly. The sudden, measured tones of a gong interrupted the brewing eye contact wrestling match. As one, the nine men turned to face a slowly opening door. Behind a filmy gauze curtain, a golden light, suffused in pastel hues, slanted down from above. The gong struck 13 strokes, and the shaft of muted golden light became a painful glare. As the glare faded, a dark figure appeared in the doorway of the arch.
"My friends, my trusted friends, It has been a while since we've all come together like this.
The Baron kept to the shadows, so only brief impressions of his appearance could be glimpsed. He was less than 6 feet tall, but his arms seemed unusually long and his legs unusually short. His head was long, narrow, and completely hairless, the cranium a shade too large and rounded to be completely human. But then he wasn't. Lakesh was one of the few members of the Trust who had ever been permitted to see Baron Kobold without the theatrical trappings to maintain his mystique of semi-divinity.
I recognize and appreciate your devotion and self-sacrifice in an undertaking that is instrumental to humanity's survival. Together we have faced enormous hardship, but never before have we contended with treachery from our own.
Lakesh noticed Salvo smiling, his teeth flashing in the murk with the hungry look of fangs.
It is with a heartbreaking sadness and deep regret I inform you that the entire structure of the Koboldville Trust might be compromised by a traitor. A traitor who will stop at nothing to prevent the Directorate from achieving a secure and rewarding future for our world.
Pudgy little Haran finally broke his silence.
Lord Baron, if you are referring to the renegades, Cain, Grant, and Baptiste, they are simply outland criminals.
How is it possible for any Ville citizen to go renegade without some type of support from within the Ville itself?
Do you mean the preservationists?
Lakesh managed to turn his smirk into a concerned pursing of the lips. The preservationists were, to employ a pre-dark term, simply bogeymen. He had exploited the fear of a small cabal of scholars, devoted to revealing the truth of man's past and future to divert attention from his own work.
No, nor do I refer to random acts of terrorism undertaken by a handful of the disenfranchised. For the past few months since the Dulce debacle, I and my fellow barons have conducted a very discreet investigation of every member of every trust in every vill. To this end, I agreed to the formation of a special internal task force headed by Mr. Salvo.
A few pairs of eyes shifted toward the man, including Lakesh's. He stood straight, shoulders squared, a half-smile playing on his lips.
The mission of the task force was to seek out at least one individual who was unquestionably in the position to weave a web of conspiracy within and without the Vills and the Trust.
Lakesh felt his throat close up. Tension coiled in his belly like a length of heavy rope. The moisture in his mouth dried, and the staged quiver in his hands became real. If it hadn't been for the prosthetic joints in his legs, his knees would have buckled.
And have you found this individual?
I have indeed, Abrams. You.
Before Abrams could blink, a pair of guards lunged from the shadows and pressed him violently between them. He stumbled and sagged, his arms wrenched up and back in hammerlocks.
Lord Baron, this is impossible! It is a slander and it's an error!
My reaction exactly, Abrams, until the proof of your perfidy came to me. I shed tears of shock and grief.
No!
Abrams glared madly and tried to struggle. If he had been 10 years younger, completely sound of limb, he might have broken free, but even then he probably wouldn't have gotten far.
Your long tenure as administrator of the Magistrate Division placed you in the unique position to choose candidates for the conspiracy. You were close to Cain's father, as I recall.
I sponsored him in the Trust, yes, and Salvo sponsored his son. In the matter of guilt, he and I shoulder the blame equally for the rogue operatives. But Cain's father didn't try to kill the Baron or you or me, Salvo.
Lakesh fought hard to maintain a staunch, impassive expression, although he noted how Salvo's eyes narrowed speculatively.
All a cunning ruse, I have determined. Cain could have easily killed you, but he didn't. Secondly, how did he know I would be in Dulce at that date, unless someone had told him?
I didn't! One of Lakesh's archivists went rogue too, remember? Why isn't he under suspicion?
Two veteran magistrates who turned renegade to one mid-grade archivist. 2-1, a mathematical law, and a solution which leads back to the division under your guidance.
Sweat shone on Abrams' face.
This is a setup. If I am removed, Salvo will take my place. Ask yourself who benefits from this. That's the real solution.
I have satisfied myself you are guilty, and I have decided on the appropriate action. Do not humiliate yourself further by making an untidy scene.
The guards spun Abrams around and lockstepped him away into the gloom. No one spoke for several moments. Then the Baron broke the silence.
Greed and ambition, they always degrade humanity. Learn a lesson from this.
The golden light flickered down to a dim glow, and Baron Kobold stepped back from the arch. Shadows enfolded him. The remaining members of the Trust stood for a moment on the carpet, silent and shaken, then grimly filed away. Lakesh was the last to leave. He tried to maintain a firm grip on the riot of conflicting emotions seething within him. Confusion, fear, relief, and suspicion all battled for dominance in his mind. He contemplated requesting a private audience with the Baron so he could review the proof of Abrams's alleged treachery. Baron Kobold, with his capricious ways, might interpret the request as a questioning of his authority, and that could result in all manner of unpleasantness. Lakesh reached the small private elevator shaft, one of three placed throughout A-level. As he stepped inside, onto the disc-shaped floor plate, Salvo smoothly slid in beside him. Salvo punched the button for C-level, the suite of offices, armories, and wardrooms housing the Magistrate Division. As the elevator began its descent, Lakesh eyed him suspiciously.
My destination is B-level, above C. Have you forgotten the layout of the administrative monolith, as well as the alphabet?
Salvo smiled with mock warmth.
I haven't forgotten a thing, you double-crossing old prick.
As if by magic, a long-barreled blaster appeared in his right fist. Under other circumstances, Lakesh might have admired the speed and muscular control with which he had drawn it from a concealed holster at the back of his gray bodysuit. He recognized the weapon as a compressed air pistol, a micro-instant before a wheezy sneeze of sound burst from the bore. Lakesh looked down at the tiny hypodermic dart embedded in his chest.
Ouch!
You have business on sea level. I need you conscious, but unable to object.
Lakesh willed his arm to reach up and pluck out the dart, but it refused to function. His muscles, his nerve endings, no longer responded. His mind remained entirely clear, but his body was numbed, incapable of movement.
Abrams, a diversion?
A necessary one. It fooled him, and it fooled the Baron.
Lakesh started to sag, and Salvo pushed him against the wall of the car, holding him erect with one hand pressed against his chest. He felt nothing.
You're Kane's intel pipeline.
You're deceiving the Baron.
Salvo grinned. His eyes, like pools of muddy water, held the same cruel glint of amusement as a cat holding a crippled mouse in its jaws.
And what the Baron doesn't know will definitely hurt you.
Salvo pulled his supporting hand away, and Lakesh crumpled down into a heap at his feet.
You're a hybrid, Strongbow.
Or a mutant.
Or both.
Silence!
He jabbed a finger at the interphaser.
Turn that goddamn thing off.
Kane's mind raced with speculations, but he really wasn't deeply shocked. After their return from Dulsa, Lakesh had said that there was more than one type of hybrid.
What about you, Lieutenant Galt? Is there some reason you and maybe all of the Dragoons hide your eyes?
Hold your tongue, Lieutenant.
Blow it out your ass. You need us to help you, and we need the truth in order to do that.
Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Grant shift, almost imperceptibly, preparing to participate in an outbreak of violence. Strongbow focused his mirrored stare on Kane. He met it unblinkingly. Slowly, carefully, Strongbow removed his glasses. Kane concentrated on maintaining his steady gaze on those golden, inhuman orbs.
Lieutenant...
Galt twitched away his sunglasses. His eyes were twins of Strongbow's own, including the faint scaled pattern around them.
Admirable deduction, Kane. And you too, Baptiste. Yes, I am a hybrid, due to a form of mutagenic molecular alteration, as are all of the Dragoons.
A corruption of the word dragon, as I recall.
Strongbow's eyes flicked back and forth across all of the people at the table.
How much do you know about the Archon's program?
All of it. We're operatives of the Trust, upper echelon. We've been told about the Nuffirult.
It was impossible for Strongbow to raise an eyebrow, but he performed a fair approximation by wiggling a brow arch.
I wasn't sure if the Barons were aware of their true bloodlines. The creatures known as the Archons were not forthcoming about their origins. Certainly, they didn't volunteer information about the last king of the Nuffirult.
Enlil, banished by St. Patrick.
Strongbow glanced at her with new respect in his eyes, though it was difficult to tell exactly what emotion shone in them. Bridget hoped it was respect.
I presume from your reaction you didn't expect your device to function this way.
No, I didn't. Nothing should have happened, except an invisible change in the magnetic field of this room. Instead, it reacted as if it were in the effect radius of a quantum interface point.
But something did happen. What was it?
You tell us. You seem to recognize that apparition.
Strongbow shrugged carelessly. Kane started to bristle at the arrogant dismissal, and Galt put his hand on the Beretta at his hip. Bridget spoke up quickly.
I can only hypothesize that the energy released by the interphaser interacted with some sort of flow already here. It opened a rift, allowing a synchronized energy pattern to partially penetrate the vibrational barrier.
My thoughts exactly.
You expected that to happen?
No, but I feared it might.
Why?
Strongbow didn't reply. He sat silently for a moment, as if mulling over a complex problem. Then, decisively, he pushed himself to his feet.
Come with me.
They followed him to a small alcove hidden between a pair of display cases. Facing a featureless section of vanadium wall, Strongbow held up his right hand. A tiny circle of light flashed on his skin, and a narrow red needle leaped out, touching first his palm and then the tips of his fingers. Soundlessly, a panel slid upward, revealing only darkness beyond. Strongbow stepped forward, and lights flickered overhead, a geodesic pattern in precisely regular channels. He led them straight ahead, with Galt bringing up the rear. After a few feet, the passageway opened into a chamber filled with so many upright glass cases that the reflection of the overhead lights confused the eye. Unlike the collection in the council room, the artifacts on display weren't reminders of humanity's need to spill blood. It wasn't a museum. It was a shrine and a trophy room. The first case they passed contained what appeared to be a thick column of dark stone, rounded on both ends. Very faint spiral designs were cut into the pitted surface.
The Stone of Destiny, also known as the Stone of Skaun, a treasured possession of the Danann, supposedly imbued with their dreams.
Mounted beside it, suspended by a spiderweb of tiny silver wires, was a sword.
The Sword of Luuk, the Longarm, a weapon said to be invincible.
On a pedestal rested an innocuous-looking hollow cylinder, barely 3 feet tall and a foot in diameter. Like the stone, spiraling, labyrinthine symbols crawled over the exterior.
A grail stone, or cauldron of Dagda. Throughout the span of centuries, it became confused with the Holy Grail.
Kane inspected and was mystified by the collection of artifacts.
I don't get it. With your hatred of the Celts, why would you go to all the trouble to safeguard their relics?
Why don't we allow the lovely lady historian to offer a hypothesis?
In terms of folklore, these objects contain the essence of Celtic beliefs. If you deny the Celts access to them, then you deny them access to their spirituality. And of course, holding the Stone of Destiny makes you, by proxy, the monarch of Ireland.
Close. My reasoning for possessing them is a bit more complex, but you're essentially correct.
If you can't put a foot on Ireland, how did you get your hands on them?
I stole them from a vault buried beneath the island of Great Skellig off the Irish coast.
Bridget smiled coldly, waving to the collection.
And having them here compromised the vibrational integrity of your headquarters. The interphaser's quantum effect field reacted to the ambient energy in the relics and opened a rift. A force came through from the other side. Who is Fand?
Kane was desperate to know the answer to that question too, but he remained silent.
At this point, it is more accurate to ask what she is. Come with me.
They followed Strongbow deeper into the chamber, past a pair of life-size statues portraying a seated, gentle-faced man in a cassock and a sword-wielding barbarian with a pair of savage hounds at his feet. Strongbow spoke as they walked, and with every step his tone gentled. From his standard aggressive arrogance, the man's attitude softened to an astonishing degree. It was as if he was relieved to break a stifling bond of secrecy, to share his knowledge with people who, if not his equals, were not utter inferiors either.
My real name is not Strongbow, as you adduced. It is Lawrence J. Karabatos. I am, or was, a scientist by training, a soldier by choice. I worked for Over Project Majestic, a subdivision of the Totality concept. I coordinated Mission Snowbird with Project Sigma, under the aegis of the Archon Directive.
Bridget had memorized an organization chart of the Totality Concept's many spin-off researches. Over Project Majestic was the only one to directly reference the Archon Directive. Strongbow cast them an over-the-shoulder glance.
Do you need me to be more specific?
You're a freezy.
Freezy. A particularly noisome piece of slang. It reminds me of a frozen confection sold in 24-hour convenience stores to slack-jawed teenagers.
None of them was sure what a 24-hour convenience store was supposed to have been, and at the moment, they were not inclined to ask. They reached an open doorway with dim lights beyond. If the large room holding the artifacts was a museum, then this small chamber was a mausoleum, or a scientist's notion of one. Pieces of medical equipment lined the right-hand wall, embalming tanks, microscopes, a centrifuge. They had seen similar instruments in Nightmare Alley. On racks and shelves rested glass jars and a clutter of surgical instruments. A wheeled stainless steel dissecting table was shoved against the wall. Its gleaming surface reflected the sickly illumination of the ceiling panels. A long, deep, transparent-walled vat occupied much of the left-hand wall space. Floating in a semi-solid gel, curled in a fetal position, was a horribly distorted caricature of a human being. The long arms and legs were drawn up and contracted. The gray-brown skin held a faint pattern of scales, and a short tail extended from the base of the spine, tucked between the thighs. The face consisted mostly of two big, opalescent golden eyes set in a hairless, narrow skull. The eyes, duplicates of Strongbow and Galt's, stared straight into eternity.
Enlil, the last of the Anunnaki, the last king of the Na'Feralt, the sun source of myth cycles, religious sects, and quite possibly humanity's common ancestor.
Kane felt his lips peel back from his teeth in a grimace of disgust. His wrist tendons reflexively tensed, hand opening to receive the sin-eater that wasn't there. Grant reacted similarly, a spasm of primal loathing overwhelming him, a xenophobic cringing from a sight that seemed utterly alien. Domi swayed, turning away, very nearly retching. The thing in the vat was probably dead, had to be dead, but she couldn't look at it. Bridget forced herself to look, focusing on the body, noting its non-human characteristics, her mind functioning in a matrix of horror and detached analysis. The creature was thoroughly dead and had lain in the tank so long that flattened, discolored lesions had formed where the skin pressed against the transparent walls. The twisted rictus on the face made it look as if it had died in extreme pain. The lipless mouth gaped slightly open. Past the neat double rows of serrated teeth, she saw a blue-black tongue. She couldn't tell if it was forked or not. Strongbow stared at the corpse longingly, almost sadly. He touched the glass with the fingertips of one hand, a gesture that looked like a caress.
Shall I tell you the story? A secret story affecting all mankind, concealed from it, and uncovered only by myself?
No one answered him. Strongbow cast them a quick glance, and they saw his thin lips briefly curve in a contemptuous smile.
You'll be the first people to hear the truth in over 2 centuries. You should be honored. You will be honored.
Bridget's and Kane's eyes met. She shook her head slightly, touched a finger to her lips.
We are, Lord Strongbow. Very much so.
Kane understood the deference in her voice and her silent warning to him. Strongbow's rigid self-control was a pose. If he hadn't already plunged off the brink into insanity, he was certainly teetering on the edge. Trapped unarmed in the bowels of the ministry building, they had plenty of inducement to put a good face to his demand. Besides, this was the kind of formation they needed, even if they couldn't confirm its veracity. Strongbow turned around to face them. His face was inscrutable. Visible over his left shoulder was the head of Enlil. The two pairs of staring, monstrous eyes sent a shudder down Kane's spine, tapping into his memories of the creatures in Nightmare Alley.
I tried to warn them, God knows, but they didn't listen to me. My security rating wasn't high enough. They forced me to make a unilateral decision. I survived, they didn't.
Warn who?
Everybody involved with the agenda, the program.
Strongbow paced restlessly back and forth in front of the vat.
As I said, I was a scientist, what used to be called in the intelligence trade an omnivore. I dabbled in many fields. For almost 25 years, I worked as a freelance consultant for the NSA, DARPA, the CIA, the DIA, NRO. Most of the projects I worked on were black-coded. Everything from microwave mind control to CBW, chemical and biological warfare. Genetically tailored diseases designed to attack humans of a certain racial heritage. That became my specialty.
Bridget and Kane kept quiet, though it wasn't easy. From what they had learned of the years immediately preceding Skydark, bio-warfare hadn't played a large part in the conflict of 2001.
I was aware of the Totality Concept projects, of course. I was briefed on their successes and failures, though I wasn't officially part of the program. I wanted to be part of it. I wanted a position I felt I had earned during all those years of slaving away in anonymity in military and government labs. In the late 90s, I was invited to work for Over Project Majestic as a liaison officer between Mission Snowbird and Project Sigma. In this division, unlike the other subdivisions, Snowbird and Sigma dealt directly with the Archons, or at least one of them, a creature called Balaam.
It was nearly impossible for Strongbow's audience to maintain neutral expressions. Bridget, through long practice in years as an archivist, had perfected a poker face, so she didn't bat an eyelash out of turn. Domi's mouth fell open a bit, but fortunately she was partially blocked from direct view by Grant's broad shoulders. Though their faces didn't reflect them, Kane and Grant shared similar thoughts. During the op in Russia, Sverdlovsk had told them how Balaam had been a guest of the Soviets for several years after World War II, before being traded to the West.
I was stationed in Area 51, the Groom Lake Proving Grounds. My job was to wring every bit of information out of Balaam that I could. As an emissary of the Archons and a drafter of the directive, I wasn't allowed to interrogate him as I would an enemy alien, pun intended. No drugs, no microwave mind controls. Just persistent questioning and research. Hours, days, and weeks of reading tedious and little-known historical works to pick up enough clues about his race's involvement with our own. I had to prove to him I knew what I was talking about, you see. Balaam supplied very few hard specifics about the Archons, but he imparted just enough so I could follow my own line of investigation. I knew, of course, that the Archons had tampered, altered, and experimented with human culture since time immemorial. Their interest in human genetics, reproduction, and even sexuality overshadowed almost all of their other activities. I won't bore you with the details of my researches, but because of my position, I enjoyed access to much suppressed or forbidden data, material that had been buried and protected since civilization began. Sumer, Egypt, and other ancient cultures repeatedly associated gods with serpents. Too much evidence in too many places violated any chance of coincidence or contamination from other civilizations. For instance, in Norse mythology, Thor's great enemy was the world serpent, just as Set was the eternal foe of Ra in Egypt. Of course, the most ancient symbol of Britain is a red dragon. As the centuries passed, the serpents, the dragons, receded further into the background, and knowledge of their true natures became the province of secret societies, extending back to the mystery cults of Greece and the Masonic builders of Solomon's Temple. I focused on the secret societies. In my day, many secret societies were networked with government intelligence agencies, the Knights of Malta, the Order of Tula, the P2 Lodge, even the Jesuits in the Vatican. Through the Vatican, I found a thread which led me to the Priory of Awen, a pagan Christian sect supposedly founded by St. Patrick around the 4th century. They were very wealthy, exceptionally keen on maintaining a low profile. They held the key to the mystery of the Archon's origins. The priory had priests placed in positions of influence in governments all over the world. I made contact with one of them, a pious drunken fool by the name of Brother Morn. He led something of a double life as both a priest and a NATO consultant on religion. Needless to say, when I arranged a meeting with him and asked him my questions, he refused to admit that the Priory even existed, let alone confirm or deny what I learned about the Anunnaki, or the Na Ferelt, as the Celts called them. I took drastic action. As a credentialed agent of Over Project Majestic, I had him abducted and exposed to all the mind control technology I had worked to develop.
Strongbow stopped pacing and tilted his head back slightly, staring at the ceiling lights. at the past.
It was an obsession. Not just to fulfill my over Project Majestic assignment, but to learn the truth about the creatures we had allied ourselves with. I felt we needed some kind of an edge. Morn's perspective was limited, but he told me about the long conflict between the Tuatha De Danann and the Anunnaki. These hostilities were the basis for the legends about a war in heaven. Only this particular phase of the war was restricted to the disposition of mankind. The last battleground was Ireland. According to Priory folklore, the Danann aided St. Patrick in ridding the island of the Serpent Folk. Embarrassed that he had accepted help from creatures he considered hellspawn, yet nevertheless grateful to them, he founded the Priory of Awen, to serve as a philosophical bridge between his own beliefs and those who still viewed the Danann as demigods.
Pausing, he frowned and shook his head, as if even now, 2 centuries after the fact, a riddle still perplexed him.
Even with that explanation, I couldn't understand why a chunk of rock in the North Atlantic was so important. But eventually I learned. What the technicians of Project Cerberus and Operation Kronos were trying to achieve through technological means already existed in Ireland. It was a seed of naturally occurring hyperdimensional gateways, quantum exit and entrance points to back alleys of space-time. Think of Ireland as the hub of a wheel in our physical universe, with a multitude of invisible spokes extending into higher dimensional space. Not that this access was automatic, but the basic requirements for it were in place. No wonder wars were fought for possession of it in prehistoric and historic times, while its people continued to cling to a rich tradition of magic, long after the rest of the world had forgotten such things. If that bit of knowledge wasn't startling enough, Morn told me about the pact struck between St. Patrick and Enlil. Simply driving the Serpent Folk out of Ireland wasn't the entire story. Enlil agreed to be imprisoned until Judgment Day, with the members of the Priory of Awen acting as his warders. At that point in time, nearly 1,000 years ago, I am certain only a few of the Nalferald still existed on Earth. According to Morn, Enlil was safeguarded in some sort of stasis chamber. The terms of the pact were simple, though clouded by myth and religious interpretation. On Judgment Day, when Enlil was set free, he was to be provided with a mate, so his race's seed wouldn't vanish forever. The mate was specifically selected. She was to bear the blood of the Tuatha De Danann.
Strongbow anticipated a barrage of questions or objections that were not offered. His listeners were too stunned to react.
Yes. If the Danann now resided in another dimension, how could a mate be supplied? And why? I came up with a provisional hypothesis, which at least fits the facts as I understand them. The creatures we know as the Archons are the products of hybridization themselves, the result of gene mingling between the Danann and the Nalferald, with the occasional superior human material added to the mix. At first, this process of bioengineering was voluntary, part of some ancient agreement between the two races. The Danann reneged, and thus active hostilities broke out. It is part of Celtic lore that the Danann practiced their own program of genetic engineering on humans, mixing their traits with those of the Irish people. It was limited, of course, sometimes seeming like the choice of a whim. More than likely, this process of hybridization gave rise to the tales of changelings, fairy children born of human parents. Over the course of the centuries, the Danann human progeny were exalted in legend as mystics, seers, and mighty warriors. Merlin is perhaps the most famous example. Saint Brigid is another.
Brigid's throat suddenly felt as dry as dust. A chill crept around her heart. She didn't want to be reminded again of the possibility of reincarnation. Strongbow smiled thinly.
However, the most interesting article of this pact was the apparent willingness of the Priory of Awen to help bring about a new dynasty of Danann and Nalferald hybrids to populate the Earth. Morn told me the Priory knew which of their members claimed descent from the Danann, and there was only one female whose bloodline was direct and unbroken. She practiced as a holistic healer and herbalist in County Meath, something of a local celebrity because of her beauty and chastity.
What was her name?
She called herself Sister Fand, evidently taking the name of a Danann princess she believed was an ancestor.
She was the woman who came through the rift?
No. Through my own methods, I managed to exploit Morn's basic, trusting nature. He came to believe I was a major player in the totality concept. Through him, I established an intelligence pipeline between the Priory and over Project Majestic. I was filled with pride and elation at my accomplishments. I had discovered the secrets of the Archons, secrets which, if properly used, could give us an advantage over them, or at least level the playing field. I brought my findings to my superiors. I expected to be rewarded with an overseer position. Do you know what they did?
I was relieved of my duties, rated a security risk. They said I had exceeded my authority, that I had risked offending the Archons, breaching a diplomatic understanding. Oh, I was kept on. Protocol demanded it. Security measures demanded it. I knew too much to be fired, and eliminating me was just as chancy. They had no idea if I had sensitive material stashed someplace to be released upon my death or disappearance. Now, after all my hard work, all my devotion, I was nothing more than a flunky, pushing paper from one non-essential department to another. Ha!
Strongbow's face split in a wide, vulpine grin. Combined with his inhuman eyes and scaled brows, the sudden display of mirth made him look demonic.
Like so many others in my life. Partners, commanding officers, lovers. They had underestimated my resolve. No reduction of rank or responsibility could take that away from me. I was absolutely determined to use what I had learned to my fullest advantage. Upon my assignment to Over Project Majestic, I spun a web of informants, contacts, and people who owed me favors. I put them to work, called in the favors. Sometimes I resorted to bribery, and infrequently, blackmail. Nevertheless, I was always aware of the current status of any totality concept project at any given time. In mid-January 2001, an ultra-classified document fell into my hands. It related to a recent experiment undertaken by Operation Kronos. The future had been peeked into, and it ended, for all intents and purposes, in less than a week. Only a select handful of totality concept personnel had been chosen to survive. I, obviously, wasn't among them. I decided to arrange my own survival, as well as to carve out a piece of the world to come for my very own. I couldn't influence the Archons, but I could and would influence their progenitors, or the last one on Earth. I knew from Morn that the Priory maintained cryonic units in their monastery, just in case the worst ever happened. Their contingency plan was to place a pair of their best members into them, to revive at some future date, so their wisdom and knowledge wouldn't vanish from the face of the Earth. I sought out Morn, and he read the Operation Kronos report. He wasn't hard to convince. I played on his conditioning, that the ancient pact must be honored. I managed to persuade him I was operating under sealed orders from the Vatican. I commanded him to acquire Sister Fand, and take us to the Priory's monastery. To his credit, he did object. But in the end, he obeyed. There, on the day before Doomsday, in a vault beneath Great Skellig, the terms of the pact were fulfilled. I revived Enlil, and he mated with the woman, impregnating her.
Impossible! Two such different life forms conceiving offspring through intercourse? Impossible.
Don't you question me.
He swiveled his head toward Brigid. The ceiling lights threw his face into pallid yellow shadow. His deep-set eyes were smoldering pits of anger.
Don't we all go through an accelerated, encapsulated process of evolution in the womb? What is humanity's common ancestor, after all? Beyond the mammal, there is the gill, the scale, the egg laid in the warm primeval ooze to the hissing, slithering serpent.
Not even Brigid could keep all the revulsion she felt from showing on her face, but she said nothing.
Evidently, the exertion of planting his seed was too much for Enlil. It was his last act. He died within moments of consummating the pact. Of course, he was incredibly ancient, on the order of 50,000 years, I estimate. I returned his body to the stasis unit. Sister Fand and I went into the cryogenic canisters and were revived a century and a half later. Sister Fand escaped me long before giving birth. She struck out in a boat hidden on the island. I tried to pursue her in another boat, but fog hid her from me. I knew she was making for the Irish mainland, and I presumed she drowned in the attempt. As for me, I took as much of the Priory's technology as I could carry and struck out for Britain. I saw a great opportunity in the chaos there, and I seized it. I appealed to the innate sense of English patriotism, waving the flag and all that. It wasn't all that difficult, in retrospect, to build an empire in only a few short years. After all, a man named Hitler had once led a nation into thinking it could rule the world, simply by making people first dare to think they could. He nearly succeeded too. And it succeeded here as well, on a smaller scale, of course. While I built the Imperium, I heard the tales of Ireland, the Eternal Fog Bank, and of the fate of the invasion fleet. I knew that Tuatha De Danann had returned, and more than likely had helped Sister Fand escape me. From information wrung from Irish spies, I learned she had birthed a pure hybrid, if there is such a thing, between the Danann and the Na Ferrolt. The girl child became a spiritual rallying point to the Celtic people. It was a threat to the Imperium to have an unconquered land, with a messiah so close to its shores. After driving the Celts into hiding here in Britannia, it wasn't politically wise to allow Ireland to keep breeding them. But I couldn't oppose the Danann by conventional military means. I needed an edge against them, so I turned to Enlil, or at least to his pristinely preserved remains.
Strongbow shook his head, as if in self-congratulatory awe at his own ingenuity.
The hybrid offspring of Danann and Na Ferrolt had escaped me. The dynasty the Pact was to create would never be realized unless I created a new one. I set out to do that perforce. Though dead, Enlil possessed all the raw material I needed. Traditional gene splicing is a painstaking process, especially without the technology available to, say, the Archons. There is no guarantee of success. Therefore, I created viral mixtures from Enlil's nucleic acids, and the virus replicated, infected, and transformed my cells. The process nearly killed me, but within a few months, my genetic code had successfully fused with that of Enlil's. You may wonder what the advantages are of such an amalgamation. Though more sensitive to high light levels, I can see into the ultraviolet and infrared ranges. My physical stamina and strength have doubled, not to mention my longevity. I calculate I could survive to see another century, barring accidents or assassination. After my successful mutagenesis, I fine-tuned the viral reaction. I modified the DNA sequence very precisely. Then I exposed volunteers to it.
Though no one turned, all of them were suddenly uncomfortably aware of Galt standing silently behind them.
There were only a few fatalities. At the end of 5 years, I had my first contingent of Dragoons, and we set about accomplishing our long-range agenda.
Which is?
The complete pacification of Ireland, and mastery of the forces bottled up therein. They work like corrosive winds, constant and eroding. Mother Fan's daughter is an adult. She has taken her mother's name, and she directs these winds. They blow pagan corruption, stripping off the topsoil of the civilized society I've built here. If this trollop controls the vortex points, she controls the fate of the world. I, for one, will not allow humankind to return to an uncouth, lumbering, barbaric clan, praying to John Barleycorn to make the crops grow. She is the conduit between the hyperdimensional gateways. Until she is killed or subdued, humanity is not safe.
You make her sound like a witch, like something out of a story to scare children.
Strongbow made a fierce gesture, drawing a finger across his throat.
If she were a mere witch, she would be less of a threat.
By your own words, she's a hybrid, maybe with some muti abilities. That doesn't make her supernatural, just different.
No. I have been considering your earlier comments regarding Psi mutants interfering with my Dragoon's ability to navigate the Irish Sea. I confess your theory has a certain degree of merit. Therefore, Morrigan will accompany you, at least until you reach the coastal waters.
And after that?
You will take a skiff to make landfall. The Cromwell will drop anchor and wait for your return. At least for a while.
Exactly how long is a while?
Whatever I deem is long enough. I will not place an arbitrary time limit on a mission of this significance. Lieutenant Galt?
My lord?
Escort our guests back to their quarters. See to their every comfort. Arrange for a cook to prepare a nourishing supper. That is all.
Galt heeled smartly around and marched out of the room. After a moment's hesitation, the four companions followed him.
I'm so glad he gave us a choice.
We were wondering how to get to Ireland. Problem solved.
Kane stole a quick backward glance. Strongbow still stood before the vat, gazing thoughtfully, speculatively, at the corpse of Enlil.
Yeah, one problem solved. Another boatload is getting ready to leave port.
Kane leaned on the railing of the foredeck and drew in deep lungfuls of air. Brine and kelp and a wet wild wind sent shivers of excitement through him. The hull vibrated slightly as the Cromwell's turbines pushed it farther into the open sea. Although it was very close to dawn, he could see only a gray emptiness stretching to a deeper gray of the horizon. The rising sun was a faint orange smudge in the eastern sky. He took a slim cigar from an inner pocket of his long coat, comforted by the weight of the Sin-Eater holstered on his right forearm. Cupping his hand around the lighter, he set fire to the cigar. He relished the bittersweet smoke mixed with the tang of salt. He stood and puffed on it, letting the restless panorama of rolling waves, the deep rumble of the ship, and the thundering strength of the ocean fill him. For a reason he could not identify, he loved it. Kane looked behind him at the elevated bridge housing. Through the tinted glass, he discerned the outlines of several sailors. Brant, the helmsman, kept his attention focused on the control console, holding a steady course. Armed guards were posted at stern and bow, clad in the red jackets and berets of the Imperial Dragoons. His companions were in cabins below, trying to overcome mild cases of seasickness. For some reason, he had been spared. He knew he should be with them, discussing strategies and options, though there was little to discuss. Certainly, they had been given no chance to escape, and even if they had, it appeared easier to reach Ireland than the Wildroot Gateway. They had to go through with Strongbow's mission, at least until they reached their destination. What would happen after that was a complete mystery. Exhaling a puff of smoke, Kane wondered darkly whether he had done the right thing by not telling the others about his Mattran's dream and his recognizing of Fand. The sky lightened, a pale, weak sun climbing into the sky. A foot sounded on the deck behind him. Moving with an easy, enviable grace, Morrigan padded up to the rail on soft-soled boots. She wore a hooded jacket that shadowed her blue-white eyes.
Good morning to you, Cain.
Cain nodded amiably, noting the change in her speech. The proximity of home, he wondered, or the distance from Strongbow?
Do you detect any psionic activity from out there, Morrigan?
If I did, I wouldn't be telling you. I was conscripted into Strongbow's little navy like you and your friends. But I'm not about to do what he wants me to. Not if it could bring harm to me home.
How long has it been since you've visited Ireland?
A very long time.
Then you should be happy to be on this voyage.
I will not reach Ireland, nor will this ship.
Is that a premonition of yours?
One needn't be clairvoyant to know this attempt will fail as many others have.
Now, why do I have the feeling you'll see to that?
I do the Priory's bidding.
I got the distinct impression from Strongbow that the Priory went up in smoke over 2 centuries ago.
Enclaves of priests were scattered all over the world. As long as the spirit of Ireland lives, so does the Priory of Eowyn. I glimpsed in all your minds thoughts of something called the Preservationists.
Yes, but they don't exist.
Perhaps not under that particular name, no. But there are groups who do function in a manner similar to that lot. They are dedicated to keeping the truth alive and spreading it on the winds. Someday the fires of wisdom will burn through the clouds of ignorance, and there will be peace and justice again. You have hidden allies in your struggle. so do not give in to despair.
Kane said nothing. Her emotionally charged words touched only a cold hollow within him. What meaning and hope could there be in sailing a dark sea of cruel insanity? Morrigan pushed back her hood. The wind wafted her long, unbound hair in careless streams. The delicate tip of her tongue touched the droplets of water on her lips. Kane's heart suddenly stumbled, then began to race.
She's lovely.
Why, thank you.
A simple fact, not necessarily a compliment.
Nevertheless, I'll accept it as one. I've not heard such comments for longer than I care to remember.
She moved toward him until she was so close he could feel her body heat, even through the tough fabric of his coat. He did not draw back. The rail prevented him. He dropped the cigar at his feet and ground it out.
Tell me, Morrigan, who is Fand? Who is she really?
Morrigan placed a hand on his cheek. Despite the chill air, her touch was warm, almost electric.
Ah, you loved her once. You fought battles for her. It did not matter to you that she was nae human. Your heart saw only your kinship, not your differences.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Your spirit understands. Fan's spirit understands. You were separated. Great was your sorrow, Cain. The druids gave you a draught of forgetfulness. It is said that Mananam, the sea god who was jealous of their love, spread his cloak between Cuculain and Fand so that they would meet no more throughout eternity.
Cain stared into her sightless eyes, groping for a response.
I'm not this Cuculain.
You are. And ye are not. But Fand is still Fand. If you meet again, she will kill the part of you which is not Cuculain. Not out of malice, but out of love. That is why I told you to flee.
A kaleidoscope of recent memories and fresh hurts wheeled through Cain's mind. He remembered the Cain he had been. Prideful, assured, feet planted firmly on a life path. The Cain who had emerged from the old was plagued with self-doubts, with gnawing fears, angers, and sometimes even a despondency.
Maybe that might not be such a bad thing.
Morrigan leaned toward him. Her breath carried the scent of fresh flowers and cleansing summer breezes.
It would be a very bad thing. You are a man. Your spirit in transition and the process is painful. You must endure it.
Under their feet, the Cromwell rocked slightly. Morrigan stumbled, and Kane's arms steadied her. For a long moment, she was aware of nothing but the feeling of her body against his. Looking down into her upturned face, he realized bleakly it was a very long time since he had kissed a woman, and an even longer time since he had wanted to. He wanted to now. He bent and touched his lips to hers, first tentatively, then with an urgent burning passion. She responded hungrily, one hand at the back of his neck, forcing his head down. Cain had no idea how long he stood there and kissed her. Finally, his sixth sense rang a faint alarm, and he reluctantly pushed her away, lifting his face from hers. Through the glass enclosing the bridge, he saw Bridget staring down at them. Though her face held no particular expression, she quickly averted her eyes when their gaze met. Feeling foolish and angry because he did, Cain disengaged himself from Morrigan. A tantalizing smile played over the woman's full lips.
She's your Anamkara. She will forgive you this dalliance, I promise you.
There's nothing to forgive.
Oh, yes, there is. Between you two, there is much to forgive, much to understand, much to live through, always together.
Cain regarded her with slitted eyes, then glanced uneasily up. Grant stood at the window and gestured toward him sharply.
We'll continue this later.
Her heart-shaped face changed in an instant, becoming grave and joyless.
I fear not, Cain. A pity, too.
Cain climbed the ladder to the bridge. The instrument lights cast a greenish, unhealthy glow around the room. Domi's face in particular looked remarkably bilious. She gave Cain a disapproving frown as he came in. Bridget and Grant stood on either side of Brandt at the navigator station.
We've got a strong sonar hit. Bearing 00.0, dead ahead. Depth of 8 fathoms, distance 2 miles. Speed is around 20 knots.
Kane shouldered in to look at the round sonar screen. The glowing sensor sweep connected with a tiny bead of light, and a warning chime sounded.
How long until we make visual contact with the Irish coast?
At present speed, less than 1 minute. However, the fog bank will seriously impair our range of vision.
Kane looked through the window at the open expanse of water, then back to Brandt.
What fog bank?
The man inclined his berated head forward.
That one, sir. A real pea super, to coin a very old phrase.
Kane, Grant, Domi, and Bridget all looked again toward the gently heaving ocean surface.
Grant, do any of you see a fog bank?
No, not even a mist.
There's nothing out there.
With all due respect, you Yanks must be blind. Or daft.
From a shelf on the bulkhead, Kane took high-powered binoculars. According to what Brandt had told him upon embarking, they had image stabilizers and ultra-low dispersion elements in the lenses to allow distortion-free long-distance viewing.
It's obvious what's happening. We're entering the so-called Gius field Strongbow told us about. The four of us are immune to it, as he theorized.
That's why his Psi-Muti is aboard, to help us through it.
I wouldn't count on much help from her.
He touched a button on the binoculars to increase the magnification. The ocean seemed to swell in size. At the very limit of the binoculars' range, dark cliffs climbed steeply from the horizon. Excitement coursed electrically through him.
I see it. Ireland.
He handed the binoculars over to Bridget. A rapid series of chimes rang. On the sonar screen glowed a jumble of racing sparks like a swarm of radioactive bees.
You see that, Brandt?
The Selkies.
He flipped up a metal cover on the console and thumbed an inset red button. Plucking a microphone from the board, he raised it to his lips.
All hands to battle stations. I repeat, all hands to battle stations. Prepare to repel boarders.
In a matter of seconds, all the crew were at their stations and the deck was devoid of movement. Brandt silenced the klaxon, and the ship was quiet with a kind of quivering anticipation. He replaced the microphone in its clip and touched a pair of levers. The throb of the engines dropped in pitch. All of them felt the ship slow.
What are you doing, Brandt?
Cutting back on our speed. We can't see where we're going in this fog.
There is no fog. Even if there were, you've got your instruments.
They can't be relied on. If you were a seaman, you'd know you can only trust your own senses.
Which are being screwed around with.
The closer we get to the coast, the more pronounced the mental interference.
The sonar screen was alive and alight with tiny swimming specks.
Whatever they are, they're globing us.
Kane's hands ached to take the controls away from Brandt. But without training, it would be a futile gesture.
Contact in about 30 seconds.
Kane swept his gaze over the bridge room, then stepped to the fire control board. He studied its layout quickly, hands poised over the row of buttons and toggle switches. He punched one, flipped another.
The anti-submarine system is armed. I've linked it to the sonar.
We didn't come here to fight.
Kane glanced again at the ghostly outlines on the sonar screen.
I don't think we'll have much choice. Grant, give him a taste. We might be able to scare them off.
Grant's fingers played over the buttons. On the deck, the four long, hollow barrels of the limbo emplacement gouted thunder and smoke. The depth charges splashed into the sea to port, starboard, and aft. Scarcely had the ripples begun to spread when columns of water erupted in roaring geysers. The Cromwell rocked from the four nearly simultaneous concussions. The sonar screen blurred and blanked, momentarily overwhelmed by the shockwaves. When it flashed back on, Kane scrutinized the readings.
We tore a hole in the globe, but they're still coming straight for us.
He peered through the water, streaming over the tinted glass of the window. Less than 20 yards away from the prow of the Cromwell, he saw a faint swirl and streak of movement just beneath the ocean surface, darker gray against the sea. He also saw Morrigan standing serenely at the railing. He grabbed the microphone.
Damnation.
Morrigan, get away from there. Come inside.
She affected not to hear him, as if she had suddenly gone deaf as well as blind. Kane dropped the microphone and rushed for the hatchway.
Kane!